Welcome to the Cabin Cast, your getaway primer.
Hello.
Hey, Eric.
How you doing, Kristen?
I'm good. Can you believe there are still snowflakes today in Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. It's April, and they always joke about the fall spring, like spring arrives, and then it's like a joke.
Yeah.
And then a few weeks later, it's snowing again.
Right.
This time last year, there were still maybe 15 inches of ice on the lakes, so I don't mind a little bit of flurries. It's melting as soon as it's hitting the pavement, so...
It's interesting to watch the seasons change and compare it to years before. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and it's actually a nice way, too, to teach my children about being patient because they want to put shorts on immediately. I think I've talked about they would wear shorts all year round if I let them.
Right.
But when it's so cold outside in Wisconsin in the winter, like that first 30-degree day, you want to put like a tank top on and run around in shorts and a tank top. But then once you get used to the 50s and 60s and then it hits 30 again, you're like, oh man.
Right.
So, looking forward to the 50s coming back here this week and things rolling into a real spring.
Well, it's amazing that just a few weeks ago, we were interviewing Jed and Matt on frozen lakes about ice fishing.
Yep.
And today we have a great interview with Craig from Fall Line Outfitters to talk about fly fishing. And even though he's going to explain that the fly fishing season lasts from, I think, January to October, we really think of it kind of as a more summer sport often. So what a jump to go from ice fishing to now thinking about fly fishing. It's a really, really fun interview we had today.
Yeah, and we just, I don't have a ton of experience with fly fishing. And your husband and son both fly fish and your dad, right?
Yep. My dad kind of started it all. He lives out in Montana and does a lot of fly fishing. He and his friends go on, you know, big guided trips all over the place, but then he also will just go down to the river. My husband and I were just out in Montana 2 weeks ago and Brian and my dad went fly fishing every day.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a visual, beautiful sport. Just the arm motions, it's so fluid, and it's so quiet, right? Bass fishing and all those things are really cool on the lakes around here, but it's pretty loud. I mean, you got trolling motors, you got guys with dual 300 motors where the tip of their boat goes about to 12 o'clock. It's just flying around the lakes as fast as they can. It's more of an action sport where fly fishing is contemplative and there's a lot of strategy. It seems like a chess match that you're playing based on how Craig was describing it.
Right.
And it's a beautiful sport.
Well, and one of my favorite movies, and I'm sure it's a lot of our listeners' favorite movies, is A River Runs Through It. I absolutely love that movie. And, you know, a lot of it is about fly fishing as the backdrop. And one of the famous quotes out of it, I thought I'd read, it's Norman MacLean, the author. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John, the favorite, was a dry fly fisherman. And I know that movie and people that maybe don't know much about fly fishing, that's what they picture is that serenity and peaceful vision of what fly fishing looks like from that movie.
Yeah, and Craig actually explains what dry fly fishing is and what the difference between dry and wet, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And then I have a little correction to make in my interview. I got two companies mixed up with an origin story. So I thought that the story was with Orvis, which is a really kind of world famous fly fishing company, but I was actually thinking of Cabela's. So this is a story of an origin of a company, the origin tale of Dick Cabela, who founded the outdoor goods chain Cabela's and who died this week at the age of 77. So this was February 21st, 2014. In 1961, according to company lore, Cabela bought $45 worth of hand-tied lures to sell at his family's furniture store in Nebraska. Customers weren't interested, so Cabela bought an ad in the magazine Sports Afield offering 5 flies in exchange for 25 cents in postage. When people wrote in to redeem the offer, he put their names in a mailing list, which he blasted with 3-page-long catalogs of fishing gear. So, you know, talk about putting bait out there for people where you just do... which is just genius marketing back in the time, as you cover your cost, right, of the flies and put them out there just to collect. Now, you know, if you want to get people's emails, you put 15% off offers on pop-ups in your screen. But he was really doing it the old-fashioned way of hand collecting them and then, you know, getting people that were interested and going it from that route. And he built an empire based off of that.
It's a great, great story. And it makes me also think, because I have a lot of... vintage Sports Afield catalogs and magazines. I know that you collect old magazines too, and I want to go back and find one of those ads.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, you'll have to look and see if in 1961, it'd be interesting to see when that first one popped up and do some research.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, the art in those old magazines is so cool too. And I've talked about that. I kind of wax poetic about they spent so much more time writing copy, right? You weren't going to scroll past it. You look at the page, you look at the hand-drawn artwork. There's some really cool hand-drawn artwork. And then the copywriters, I mean, just to write a small ad that goes out, they really spend time and energy and effort in that.
The Great Pyramid of Giza, Colossus of Rhodes, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and Roughing It in Style. All of these equal in history and magnitude, but only one you can visit now. You see, Roughing It in Style may not be ancient, but it's the only wonder that will bring wonder to your world. Roughing It in Style is your source for interior design, furniture, reclaimed cabinets, and decor. They have 2 stores, one out west in Fort Collins, Colorado, and one up north in Harshaw, Wisconsin, 10 miles south of Minocqua. Plan your visit today and find out more at roughingitinstyle.com.
What was that?
The pyramid's still around? Why didn't anyone tell me? Roughing It in Style, a much better place for your furnishing needs than the Great Pyramid of Giza.
So Craig started Fall Line Outfitters after leaving the military, and you'll hear about a little bit about his military career and his inspiration and how his skills that he learned in the military have kind of lended into small business ownership. But anytime people come back with passion and bring special businesses to a city that needs it, you know, I think with the internet, it's so easy to lose sight of local places, and having new people come in with energy and excitement and ideas, bringing special shops into small towns again, just make sure you're out there supporting them. That's important. It's so important to stop by those local shops and check them out, and definitely check out Craig's Instagram. He does really funny videos there. You know, they put them out, really informative stuff. And if you want to know more about fly fishing after listening to this, definitely check out his stuff.
Yeah. And it's a easy, great stop if you're driving up north to stop and visit with him and see what his shop is all about.
Yeah. And again, that is Fall Line Outfitters. We had a really good chat with Craig. We appreciate him making the drive up. And I think you guys are going to absolutely love it and want to learn more. We are excited to welcome Craig Cook from Fall Line Outfitters Company. Fall Line Outfitters is a unique small outdoor outfitting brand that Craig founded in 2018 after serving a 20-plus year military career. They provide outdoor recreation opportunities and outdoor gear. Fall Line Outfitters is in historic downtown Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Welcome, Craig.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you here. Our little neighbor down to the south of where our recording studio is in Stevens Point, and learn a little bit more about fly fishing today. So when did your interest in fishing begin?
So I think my interest in fishing began when I was a small child, kind of like a lot of us. We have good memories of dads and grandpas taking us out. And my father was really big into outdoor hunting and fishing. And where the fly fishing kind of took off was we had a cabin down in southeastern Wisconsin on a lake. And my grandfather, who was a World War II veteran, they would stay out there during the summertime and have us, all the families and the brothers and sisters and cousins, come out to the lake fishing. And my grandfather, that generation, they were always a little stingy with their things. They kind of grew up in that era where they never had a lot of stuff. So my grandfather, you know, he always kept a pretty close eye on what the grandkids would take or borrow from the cabin. But there was this long wooden pole hanging up in the cabin that looked pretty interesting to me. And normally I would have asked permission to check out and see what it was. But I was a little daring this time, and I decided that I was going to reach up there and grab this thing off the wall and take it down to the water by the pier. And unbeknownst to myself, I didn't know it was a fly rod, old fly fishing rod, made out of bamboo. And, you know, we tried fishing it like a normal spin rod, and it was have none of it. Yeah. It learned really fast that, you know, this thing is very unique, and the way that this has to be casted is just much different than I'm used to. So after a few attempts, we were able to kind of get the dust off the reel and get the line out there. And I kind of self-taught myself how to fly fish at my grandparents' cabin in southeastern Wisconsin. And it was just something that I really fell in love with due to the fact that you constantly have to be doing something, and it's just an old art that has been around for a long time.
Very cool.
Yeah, there's that activity to it, which is really fun. It's so visual, and you know, there's the iconic photos, and the flies are so beautiful. I mean, there's just so much to it, and the gear and the equipment and the style. It really has a lot to it. And you know, as a kid, I grew up at bobber fishing, right? And after a while, you get bored of watching a piece of plastic floating in the water, and you want to get more interested, but we didn't have the opportunities to fly fish as much. So it's pretty cool that you brought that up to the Northwoods here to kind of stoke that interest.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I retired from the military, I knew it was going to be very difficult after such a long military career to go and work for somebody. Not that I was incapable of doing such a thing, but I always wanted to, you know, be my own boss. And I, you know, when they're in the military, they always say, you know, find something, a passion, something that you're going to really enjoy. And when I thought back to all the great memories I had of being in the outdoors and then the fly fishing part of it, you know, 20 some years in the military just never left a lot of time for recreation to get back into the fly fishing. So when I looked into something that I wanted to do, I knew I wanted to be in the outdoors. I wanted to do something that was involving the outdoors. And that fly fishing passion came back to me. And that's what we decided that we wanted to do, open a fly fishing shop.
So where do people go fly fishing in the Northwoods? Is it any stream that you can go fly fish in, or how would somebody go about finding the right spots to go?
Well, the first thing I would say as a plug to a fly shop is always try to seek out your local fly fishing shop, as they'll have the most up-to-date and accurate information as far as, you know, like what kind of fish are biting, what species of fish are in the general area. In the Northwoods, there are just fantastic, as we know, there's just fantastic water everywhere. More lakes in the Northwoods than there would be streams, but there are plenty and plethora of really great streams for fishing. Some of the big species of fish that we have here in the Northwoods that people would associate the Northwoods with would be the musky fish, of course. But we have some really, really good and sustainable trout waters as well. And with technology, things have changed so much as well that you can get download apps that they have available to anybody that are going to be able to tell you like access points and, you know, are the fish biting well? How fast is the water moving? Which always, as we dive more technically into things, some women and men want to know like how fast the water's moving to get the food and the resources for the fish to get.
Well, and I think you give updates on your Instagram for weekly fishing reports. So people can always check the social media, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the unique things about a fly fishing shop. I always say a fly shop is a throwback. It's a throwback to a store where you can come in, you get to know the owners, you get to know the guides. You talk about, you know, what's biting. And one of the things that we try to provide on a weekly basis, we try to generally start doing that beginning of April timeframe, when, you know, people are kind of coming out of hibernation a little bit, is that we'll put a weekly fishing report out there as far as what bugs are hatching and, you know, the water temperatures. You know, is the water clear? Is the water going to be muddy, as we say, or stained because the water's been moving because of a, you know, cold front or rain, you know, situation. So, yeah, we are very open with where are they biting and what are they biting on.
So the is fly fishing, what makes, besides, is it just the rod? Like, you have to have a fly fishing rod and that makes it fly fishing, or is it, you know, fly fishing equates to you're on the shore or you're weighted in? I mean, do people fly fish from boats? Can you go on the lake? Is that still fly fishing, or is it just a river thing? Can you break down just the what fly fishing is and kind of a general?
Yes, I think what defines fly fishing is the equipment that you're using. Fly fishing is normally going to be a much longer rod. The reels that you use in fly fishing aren't necessarily going to have the hold down, push down button, as you refer to with the bobber fishing. It's going to be more where you pull the line out yourself. And the main component of a fly fishing rod is the line. That's the major component that separates itself from regular fishing, where the line itself is the weight that's going to project the fly out onto the water. And then when we talk about fly fishing, of course, the word fly, which can be spelled different ways when you refer to fly fishing, it could be the F-L-Y or the F-L-I-E, you know, it can be different things, but you're using a fly or a bug that's going to emulate something that's hatching during a specific time of the season. Not that you don't use specific bait for different types of fishing, but the fly fishing is very specific to the hatch. And we always say in fly fishing, you match the hatch. So you're going to match what's currently hatching at a certain time of the year, and that's the fly that you're going to pick out and use.
I know my dad is a big fly fisherman, and he has different boxes of flies for the different places goes fishing too. So it just depends on where you're at for what might be hatching there that you're going to pick out.
Yeah, absolutely. So we always try to have flies, of course, that are going to be for central Wisconsin, the North Woods. We'll even have flies for different parts of the state of Wisconsin as well, because, of course, people are traveling all over and doing some fly fishing. But we have a lot of folks from Wisconsin who at certain times of the year want to go out west, where fly fishing is even a bigger sport than it is here in Wisconsin. And a lot of times when they come in, they'll say, you know, hey, I'm going out to the Yellowstone, or I'm going out somewhere in Idaho, or, you know, Colorado. What do you recommend? And we always say, visit your local fly shop out there, because what's hatching out in Colorado, Montana, or out west is not going to be the same hatch that we have here in Wisconsin. And for me to sell or to recommend flies for you here to pick up in Wisconsin to take out there, I wouldn't be doing you any injustice. And those fly shops out there are fantastic. They're, you know, they're going to be the subject matter expert when it comes to what's hatching.
So flies too have such a visual aspect to them, right? And there's people that tie their own flies and then you can buy them from shops, and there's like crazy amounts of money that they go for. It's almost, I mean, it is an art form. On top of that, where is the balance between, like, do people use these artistic flies? Is that the thing? Or is it more, those are display flies and you sell at your shop, do you sell fancy flies that are more artwork and then usable ones? Or is it all together, like blended?
So the flies that we carry are all usable flies. And it's really neat. The really cool aspects about fly fishing is it, I always say that you have two different aspects of it. You have the angler who, you know, goes out to the stream and either will come into the shop and buy the flies again, like to match the hatch, or they tie their own flies to use for fishing. But then you also have another group of people that do not fish, but absolutely just love tying flies and the art of tying flies, as you had mentioned. There's nothing like where you try to emulate something that actually hatches to make that look so realistic that a fish, whether it's a muskie or a trout or a bluegill, does not know the difference. And that's really the unique part of it. There are folks who are just getting into fly fishing, and one of their big questions is, well, if I don't tie a very good fly, are the fish going to bite? And I always say, yes, it doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, do the best you can. Most of the time, depending on the species of the fish, because some fish are a little more finicky than others, they're going to go after it. And in my opinion, there's nothing like tying your own fly and catching a fish with your own fly. So no matter how in depth it is or how good you are at it, tie it. And you can save yourself a little bit of money too, instead of having to buy a fly every time you lose one in a tree or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. So my son also fly fishes and he ties his own flies. He has a desk in his room and all the different supplies around. It's fascinating. And the names of these flies crack me up. Like the woolly bugger, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah.
And there's some other really interesting names and supplies that are used. He'll order some online from places or go to local shops. And it's fascinating. Can you talk about some of the names of these things and what they mean, how they get them?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the really unique thing is, and I'm sure there's going to be some peers, fly fishermen and ladies that are listening to this that could correct me. But I would say that, you know, the names are endless. There has been so many different times where folks have created their own fly patterns. And my name's Craig. So now I'm going to call a fly the Craig Hatch. I mean, just as an example. So the names really, a lot of them are just traditional flies that have been around for many years. They've just changed a color or two. So they'll keep the woolly bugger name. But a lot of the flies that we see today are from, and I'll call them artists, the unique people that are tying these really intricate, really neat flies. They'll name it after a former car or a big fish they caught or whatever the case may be. So the names are just kind of all over the board, to be quite honest with you, opposed to some of the more traditional flies that have been around for a long time. I know that there is a really favorite fly that was created down in the Driftless region, southwestern part of the state. And all it is pretty much a tungsten bead with some, they call it flashaboo. It's kind of a shiny material. And then they wrapped it with some pink on there and it's called the pink squirrel. So, you know, doesn't really look like a squirrel at all, but somebody came up with a unique name, and that is just a fantastic fly that is now used not only primarily in the Driftless area, but we see people that are using that fly all over the state of Wisconsin. So kind of a unique way of how that fly got its name. So you could create a fly tomorrow and you can name it right after yourself.
Well, you know, my son, if everybody that's listening goes to our Instagram, they can see some video and photos from tonight's recording. And Craig has on a buffalo plaid red and black shirt right now. And for Mother's Day 2 years ago, my son made me a buffalo plaid fly. It had red and black buffalo plaid for the body. So, yeah, I'm going to name that one after myself.
Perfect.
Right? You should. Yeah. You deserve it.
Right.
Especially for, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Now, the different artists that do that. So there's a version of collect, like there's people that just collect flies that don't even fish, right? Mm-hmm. On top of the people that make them. And what, I mean, there's, well, pre-COVID, probably big fly fishing shows and different things around the country. What, if you're a beginner, right? And you don't want to get too overwhelmed, you go to your local fly shop, you talk to them. What does it take to really get involved? Is it, I mean, you need the full kit, the waders, the whole deal? I mean, you, or do you just need to buy a starter pole and a couple, you know, what does it take to start fly fishing and what do you recommend for people interested?
Well, it's a great question because it's probably been the number one question that we've received within the last year by far. We've seen such a large influx of folks that want to get into the sport. You know, we kind of talked a little earlier before we started the podcast that a lot of things are image and, you know, folks, and I understand, you know, folks see somebody doing something on a magazine or in a video, they want to emulate that or they want to try it. And so we've seen a resurgence of people getting into fly fishing because of the image side of it. But we've also seen people reconnect with the outdoors. And we have a lot of folks that will come into our shop and they'll say, I've never done it before. I don't know really anything about it. What do I need to get into this? And I always say that we're kind of and again, this reverts back to being an old fashioned type of store fly shops are. I always say, you know, I never grew up with a plethora of money to just buy everything. So I've always been just, let's get the basics. Let's get you going into it. Let's have some fun. You can always add some of the things down the road. So a lot of the different companies, not only that I rep, but other shops rep, they make what they call a fishing kit or a combo kit. And what it is, it's a fly rod in a box, and the fly rod has everything that you need to go out and tie a fly on there and catch some fish. Very reasonably priced. You don't need to spend a ton of money on it. And as I always tell the customers that are getting into it, you always will have this rod if you decide you really love the sport and you want to upgrade and get other things. So really all you need is that fly rod and a few flies. The waders that will come down the road, the boots that go with the waders, the packs, you know, all the really neat lightweight shirts that people like to wear for fishing. You know, that's all great stuff. And there's an application for it. But for the beginning fly fishing men or women, it's really a minimal investment to go out and have a really good time.
Do you see a lot more women getting interested in fly fishing?
Yeah, absolutely. We really try hard at Fall Line to create an environment for that women feel very comfortable coming in. And we do. I would say that, believe it or not, 60% of our customers that come into our store are women. There's a reason for that. The one reason would be that there is a lot of women that are interested in fly fishing, but you know, a lot of the women come in and they get, you know, they'll buy gear, or they'll ask questions to buy flies for their husband for a birthday gift, which is pretty, pretty cool. But yeah, we absolutely do. We've seen the numbers have gone up so much with everybody getting into the sport, but especially women. And I know like throughout the state, they have some really good getaways for women to get together with a group of friends and do like a fly fishing seminar for a weekend. So they really promote it. And, but it's a fantastic sport. No matter if you're a man or a woman to get into it. And we carry gear for both.
I'm sitting here looking at your hat and thinking about your shop name. So Fall Line, what does that term mean in fly fishing?
So ironically, it doesn't mean a whole lot about fly fishing. My family was really big into downhill skiing, and the term fall line is when a skier gets to the top of a mountain and looks for that perfect line to go down the hill. And then the other terminology of fall line that does coincide more with the outdoors, and I guess it could go with the fly fishing, is that when two streams meet on the mountain, it creates a river. So it's got some sentimental, that's the kind of the reason behind the name. And then it kind of just took its own life or form of life when we opened and did more of the fly fishing aspect of it.
Very cool.
What's the difference between a dry and a wet fly? You hear that, I mean, there's so much terminology. Yeah. How does that play?
Yeah, absolutely. So a wet fly is going to be something that's going to be subsurface or below the surface of the water. A lot of times before a fly, not all flies, but when flies hatch, they'll start off as like a larva, or they call it a nymph. And it's going to be more of a bead head with in the fly fishing, the fly is going to have a shank coming off of it. And that's going to emulate that nymph or that larva coming up from underneath the bottom of the river. And as it comes up, that's a subsurface fly. So the nymph would be a subsurface fly. There's another fly that's going to be very popular called streamer fishing for fly fishing. It's a streamer. It's a longer fly. It's sometimes they have two hooks on them. That's something where you're going to cast it out. You're going to let it sink down below the surface of the water. And then in fly fishing, instead of reeling, they don't call it reeling. They call it stripping. So you're going to strip your line in forward towards you to get the action of that fly to move in the water. So that's what you would call a wet fly. It's going to be underwater, so it's going to be wet. So a dry fly now is that fly, when that fly takes shape and it matures and it hatches outside of the water, it now will fly. There's the fly part of it. And that fly will then either fly away or it will rest and sit on top of the water. So when you see fly fishing movies or any of that, you know, any kind of fishing, honestly, and the bait or the fly is on top of the water, essentially that's considered a dry fly. So that's kind of the difference.
And then from an activity standpoint, that iconic kind of whipping the hand back and forth. So you're just leaving the line out there, floating it up in the air and trying to bring it back down to do multiple hits on the water.
Yeah. So when I first started doing fly fishing, I thought, oh, this is really neat. So you're going to cast the rod back. The fly is going to go back almost like a bullwhip action. And as it comes forward, you're going to let it just touch the water, and then you're going to bring it back, and you're going to, and honestly, what some applications you do that, but for a lot of times you get your timing down so fine that you're able to cast the rod. And every time you do a back cast, the momentum of that fly and that line is going, it's extending out farther. As you bring the momentum of the fly rod forward, the weight of that line takes over and the fly whips forward, and you let go with your, depending on what hand you're casting the rod with and holding the line with, you're actually going to let go of your line a little bit, and it's going to go further and further out. My point is that you don't want to let the fly touch the water. depending on where you want your cast to land. So if there's a pocket or a pool that you see some trout are in, or you think there's going to be a really good area for a trout, and you want to pinpoint that fly to land right in there, it may take you several casts, depending on the distance, for the, before that fly is going to hit that pool of water. So that's kind of the momentum of the traditional fly fishing cast. When you see that, what they're doing every time that they cast before they drop the line is they're just getting more and more distance.
Oh, you're working on the line. It's like working it down the river.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's really interesting. And then you got to play the current too.
Then you got to play the current. A lot of times, I would say 90% of the time you're always fishing up current. I'm a big trout fisherman. A lot of times with the trout, the vibration off of you walking in the water will scare them. People have this misconception that I'm going to buy a fly rod and I'm going to be Brad Pitt and the river runs through it and I'm going to catch all this trout. Uh-huh. And even though we all want to look like Brad Pitt, fly fishing.
Wait, what do you mean want to?
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, we got to be modest, yeah. I guess. But when you're casting, when you go upstream, the fish are always going to have their tails and they're going to have their heads pointing up the current. So their tails are always going to be down current. So if you're standing downstream and you cast the fly up in front of them, now it's symbolizing like it's regular food coming through and they're more apt to grab it. Opposed to if you're walking downstream and casting your fly, well, now A, they're going to see you, they can feel the movement and their heads are pointed towards you. So that's, we always let, tell folks, if you can, because there's some circumstances that you can't fish upstream. You have to fish down, to do it. But then if you get into a river where the current's running really fast, and if you're immersed into the water, if you're immersed into the stream with your waders on, and you can fly fish from shore without a doubt, and you can fly fish from a boat. I know that was one of the things we talked about at the beginning, but a lot of times folks will get the waders and they'll, submerge themselves into the stream. But if the current's running really fast, one way that kind of helped that, instead of standing in the middle of the river and casting your fly upstream, that fly will be past you in a matter of no time. So we always tell folks to pick a side and stand to one side of the stream and cast upstream and allow that fly to come past you and then go downstream and then retrieve your fly after it's downstream. So that gives you a little more time and it puts that fly in front of the fish a little longer.
Because they're not reacting to the hit on the water. They're reacting to the fly floating across.
Yeah, so it really depends on how hungry they are, what the hatch is. So there are times where as soon as you throw that fly in the water, they'll hit, which is just beautiful. But a lot of times, you're absolutely right. A lot of times it's throwing that fly down, it makes the splash, it comes down past them. And at least for trout, and I'm not a big musky guy, so I can't speak to musky a whole lot, but at least for trout, they'll either take it right away or they're not interested in it. And the hatch could be going on. You could have a certain bug that's hatching and they could just be, it could be a feeding frenzy literally. And 2 minutes later, it will all shut off. It's that crazy. It's absolutely that crazy. And the bugs are still hatching, but they're just done eating. We're done. They're very finicky. They can be very finicky at times, but and the really unique thing too about fly fishing is that there's, without getting too technical, there's three components to a fly fishing line. And like when we refer to like bobber fishing with a worm, we have the clear line. I'll just say the clear line, which hopefully the fish don't see it. They all they see is the worm dangling there. But with a fly fishing line, you your line is either fluorescent or it's a different color. But that's your weight. We don't put lead weights on fly line. The line, like I said earlier, is your weight. So you have your fly line, which is your weight that, that you extended out there. Then you have this portion of the fly line, which is called your leader. So the leader is clear. The leader is clear, and leader is usually about nine feet long. You tie your fly onto the end of that leader, and now you're able to fish. And when the fly line comes down and it lays down, it's much softer and quieter than a regular fishing, where you have we'll just stick with the bobber and the worm. But when you throw that bobber and the worm out there, you kind of get the kerplunk,
yeah.
And then you get the ripple effect off the water. Well, the fly fishing, the way that casting goes, that fly lays down in that water really soft and quiet. So even though the fly line, people will say, well, the fly line's colored. How do they not see that? Because the leader that's on there is 9 feet long and that's nylon and it's clear. So they can't see it. And then what happens is, without going too farther in depth, is that with fly fishing, you don't have anything on there to just unclip and take the fly off. You actually have to tie your fly on there. Well, if you're tying your fly onto the leader, you have to, every time you want to change the fly, which could be several times during the day, if they're not biting on something, you have to cut the leader off with your nippers, tie a new fly on. Well, that leader that was 9 foot at one time is going to continue to slowly shrink, shrink, and shrink. Then what you do is that you add on a third line, which is called the tippet. And the tippet is going to be different sizes, but the tippet is going to extend that leader out so you can get back to that original 9 feet. So hopefully that didn't overcomplicate things or go too far in depth, but that's kind of the three-step process of a fly line.
That's interesting. Really interesting. Mm-hmm.
And then if you talk about a perfect fly fishing day, I imagine it's something that's tough in like really windy conditions. Yeah. It's just like in trouble there. So do you look for just perfectly calm, sunny days, cloudy days? What's a good day to go out fly fishing?
So the best days to go out fly fishing are going to be either a day before a rainstorm, because the barometric pressure changes and the fish pick up on that. So generally the fish are like, oh, okay, we're going to get a storm in here. The water's going to be cloudy. We need to eat today. So a lot of folks will go out as a storm front moves in, even right up to before it starts to rain, would be a great day. Cloudy days are better than sunny days, believe it or not, because if we're speaking specifically to trout, some of the other species of fish aren't quite as jittery, but trout in particular, they get spooked very easily. And if it's sunny and beautiful out and they see your shadow, kind of, you know, they'll take off. So a cloudy day is better than a sunny day. And, you know, some people that this year has been just a fantastic and phenomenal year for fishing. The bite has just been unreal. And most of the big fish that are getting caught are during days that are raining. Wow. Yeah. So so when we talk about having the right gear, some of that stuff does play into that. But, you know, like Sunday, it was beautiful out, you know, 60s. And it was like, hey, this would be a great day to go out and fish. I think normally if you're doing the worm and bobber, it probably is a fantastic day to go fishing. But for fly fishing, we had guys come into the shop on Monday morning and like, I didn't catch anything. And we're like, really? It was beautiful. Like, no, it was too nice. It was too nice to catch.
Oh, sounds like retail.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So
what's your best fishing memory? Where was it and what kind of fish did you catch?
So actually it wasn't that long ago. I have a guide in the shop, Jerry, who's just a fantastic and a trout fanatic. And people always come in and say, hey, when's the last time you went fishing? And I'm like, hey, I own a fly fishing shop. I used to fly fish. I really don't anymore.
Yeah.
But Jerry says, we're going to go out the last day of trout season. So trout season in Wisconsin generally goes from the first Saturday in January, and it goes all the way into the middle of October. This last year in 2020, closing the 15th. So Jerry says, we're going to go out and I want to show you how I take clients out. This would be great as a shop owner. I'm like, absolutely. So let's go. So we went out early in the morning and we fished for 12 hours going up a stream. I'm in pretty decent shape. I have never been that tired ever, but we got on some really neat fish. We got on some 19 inch brown trout, a 20 inch brown trout. I think he got onto another 19 inch brown trout. And the streams. So the one issue we have compared to out west, but the issue that we do have in Wisconsin is we have some beautiful, beautiful rivers and streams that have plenty of room for your traditional fly fishing. But a lot of our streams are very tree overgrowth. They're very narrow. So you're doing what we call more of your non-standard fly fishing, different kinds of casts that are associated with that. So that particular day we did a lot of non-traditional fly fishing, which was very difficult, but it really taught me a lot. And I think, you know, looking back at just an awesome experience and memory was going out with him and just learning just so much from him. He's such a fantastic teacher, but you learn more sometimes doing things that are non-traditional than if I would have gone out to a stream that was wide open, beautiful out. I've got my full cast going on. So I think that would probably top my experience.
Yeah, that's very, very true.
So you had a 20 plus year military career and talk about the transition from something like, you know, so specific, you're in the military, it's a totally different life to becoming a small business owner. And then if you could share too, how you work with veterans in your current at Fall Line as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So transitioned out of the military after 22 years of service, and it was exciting time to transition, but at the same time, it was nerve wracking because I've done this military career for so long. Everything is so organized and lockstep and planning, and now we're kind of getting into this where I have all this freedom, so to speak, to kind of like plan my future out. I just knew it was gonna be very challenging for me to work for somebody. Not that I couldn't do it, but it just, I wanted to be my own boss. So when I did all the research, after I decided I wanted to do fly fishing in the outdoor, I met with like the local small business centers, huge resources, and did a lot of research with the DNR to find out like how many fishing licenses are sold in this particular area, how many trout stamps are sold in this particular area, you know, all this different research to make a good decision into the business side of things, which ultimately did pay off. And then when I opened up Fall Line Outfitters, I had a rep in the fly fishing industry when I called and I said, you know, I want to open a fly fishing store in Stevens Point. And the gentleman said, that's never been done before. And I said, exactly. That's why I want to do this. Yeah. He says, well, you're going to need a lot of money to do this. And I said, I think I can work really hard and not spend a lot of money to get this going. And, he was right, but I think I was right to a little bit, a lot of hard work to get into it. But you know, yeah, to get into the sport and to have the quality gear that we offer, you obviously had to work really hard to build the business up, and we've just been blessed with have awesome customers that come in and support us. One of the biggest things people say is, do a lot of people really fly fish in Wisconsin? And the answer to that is absolutely. And it's grown so much. And a little known fact is there's only 8 fly fishing shops in Wisconsin, true fly shops.
Wow.
That's it. Now, if you go out west to a small town, there's 3 in every town.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of us out there, but there's enough to fulfill the need for it. When it comes to taking veterans out, myself being a vet, it's just really important for me to give back. And I feel very blessed. You know, I've had 3 tours overseas. I've made it home. I've been very blessed that I'm still able to do a lot of the things I love to do. Some were not. And, I'll never forget that. And I think one of the ways that I take Fall Line Outfitters is it's a vehicle for me to give back to that community. It's provided enough revenue to be able to help put on some of these trips. And then also building relationships with some of the bigger brands out there and saying, hey, this is who I am. This is what I want to do. And getting some donations from some of these bigger corporations that are in the fly fishing industry to donate gear to give back to some of these veteran organizations so that we can provide the gear that they need to go out there and have a really, really good time. So we've teamed up with a couple of the veteran organizations. We roast our own coffee. So we give back with the coffee that we do. But we have some trips planned this summer where we have some really excited veterans to get out. And I guess if I could just say real quick, when they go out, when anybody goes out on the stream, it's no different than if you go on your ski boat or if you're going out bass fishing, whatever the case is, there's just something to be said about getting on that stream and hearing the water run and the peace and quiet. And it just kind of lets everything just melt away. And that's really what we found with fly fishing. So we're really ecstatic that we're able to provide that through Fall Line.
Well, and thank you for your service too.
Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
I think it's amazing what we said. First of all, I mean, you put in 20 plus years of service like you talked about, and then for you to come back and feel like you want to give back to veterans too is really special. I think that's awesome. And you see that a lot, which is really cool. I mean, people that have careers in the military come back and they're like, well, I'm done with that. I'm good. I want to get away as far as possible from the culture and things, but it's really embraced and I think important because you know what these people have gone through and you've seen it firsthand, and then to understand, come back and do something where you understand this is something that can actually help. And the outdoor industry, I think, has done a good job of embracing veterans and coming back. Thank you for your service and thank you for doing something. I mean, service after the service is really what you're doing there too.
Definitely.
So that's really special.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that. You know, and really my mission is not to get accolades or to really put Fall Line out there that we do all these different things, because it's just important to me. It's just really, really important to me. And I can remember, you know, as I was in the service, there was a lot of different organizations and people that weren't associated to the military that reached out and wanted to, you know, lend their hand to me. And I think it's just the least that we can do. And I see the difference and the connection that I'm able to make and other people are able to make with and make a difference. And that's that's just super important. And I appreciate you saying service after service, but I just look at it like it's just the right thing to do.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Very cool. So you have a cabin yourself. So talk about what you enjoy when you get away to your cabin.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a cabin in the Northwoods, and I will tell you that it has been just amazing for us as a family to escape to on the weekends. We spent a lot of time in the Northwoods this last summer, I think like a lot of folks did. And, you know, going up there, we bring the dog, we load up the truck. We get up there kind of late after we close the shop Friday night. And if it's not too late and the mosquitoes aren't that bad, we'll get the campfire, you know, going. And we always go down to the dock, even as the sun's setting or it's dark out, and we'll do a water temp to see what it's going to be like for the next day for wakeboarding and skiing and some fishing. But roast some marshmallows. And then I'm an early riser, 5 a.m. early riser. So the next day I try to beat the sunrise up, make a pot of coffee. We have a very small cabin, so I have to kind of tiptoe around so I don't wake everybody up, but make a pot of coffee. And one thing my father created a long time ago is he had a hunting cabin, and they would always do a journal. So every time that they would come up, they would write in the journal, like, who was there? What did you guys do? So every morning after I make that pot of coffee, I'll sit there and overlook the lake inside the cabin, quietly write into the journal and write down who's here and what we're going to do. And then we'll kind of complete that on a Sunday. And then all day on the lake, it's go from sun up to sun down. My son learned how to wakeboard last year, and we put a lot of hours on the old boat last year, doing that. And then we did quite a bit of fishing as well too. So it's just made so many great memories in such a short amount of time.
I love that idea of keeping the journal too, and picturing that quiet morning.
Yeah. Sneaking around. I do that. Yeah. With trying to not wake your kids up. Like I need a moment.
Yeah, by myself. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right. Mine are a little bit older, so they're more subject to stay in bed a little bit longer, so dad gets a little bit more time. But I absolutely love those quiet mornings. So
fun. So back to fly fishing, you know, you're talking about like bugs a lot, right? Do you fly fishermen, they study bugs and how they hit the water? I mean, you look at bugs, you're like, oh, that's cool, a dragonfly landed. Or I've never really looked at bugs and how they interact with the water. I imagine as a fly fisherman, that's like a thing you think about it hunting. You think about, okay, here's the deer, the does, the bucks, they interact, the trails. But you're thinking about bugs and how fish attack bugs in and out of the water. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, in one of the biggest things I always tell people, if you want to find out what's hatching locally, is you go down to an area of the river or a lake, it can be a lake as well, overturn a rock. And sometimes, and most of the time, if you overturn a rock, a lot of times the crustaceans or the exoskeleton or the certain type of bug will be on the bottom of those rocks. Cause that's where they're going to, you know, that's their natural protection is to find somewhere to hide. So a lot of times you can pick up a rock on a lake or in a stream, and you'll have different things in there that will kind of tell you like, this is the kind of bug that's hatching right now. So that's just a kind of a tool or a trick of the trade that a lot of people will use. But yeah, I mean, there are people that really in-depthly try to figure out how some of these bugs are hatching, you know, how are they presented on the water? Again, that comes down to how you tie the fly and emulate that fly. When we talk about dry flies, like some people will actually tie a fly in different stages of growth. I mean, it's that in-depth. I mean, wow. It's not me. I'm the guy who's just going to chuck one out there and pray that I'm going to get something. But all seriousness, though, they will tie one in each stage of the growth period because they want to make sure that they're hitting that hatch at the right time to be the most successful on the water.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, after I say all this, it really is relaxing.
Yeah, sure.
I think we go in kind of depth with the hatches and the tying and everything, and it's really not that complicated of a sport, and it is super relaxing after I just got telling you everybody that people are tying flies in the different stages, but yeah.
I think it sounds very relaxing.
Yeah, you just kind of pick your strategy first, and then you got your strategy for the day, and then just go with the flow and how things are
right
going.
Do you always catch and release? Do you save any of your fish? Do you cook them? Do you mount them? What do you usually do?
So I'm kind of more of the catch and release. I would say a lot of people are it's tends to seem that a lot of people are more into the catch and release. There are, of course, the folks that do keep their catches. I'm a big smoked trout fan. So if there's generally what we'll do is if the fish is big enough, some of the bigger fish, it's good to get them out of the system, so it lets the smaller ones grow up. Then those are great. Those are great fish to be able to smoke. But I think a lot of folks, at least that we hear in the industry, a lot of folks just catch and release for the most part.
Just for the joy of fishing.
Just for the joy of fishing, absolutely.
So how do you smoke trout?
I don't have a real expensive smoker, but you can get a pretty inexpensive smoker and flay them and put some lemon and butter and let them sit in there for a while, and they're fantastic. If you haven't had smoked trout, it's pretty fantastic.
It's delicious for breakfast.
Yeah, it sounds good. And put on crackers and eggs and wow.
Absolutely.
This is what happens when we record in the evenings after our long work
day. Haven't eaten
my stomach
yet.
Is grumbling. I move away from the microphone because you can hear it grumbling now talking about this. Delicious.
So do you just carry fishing equipment? You have other apparel and things too?
Yeah, so we call ourselves a hybrid fly shop. So we're 50% all fly fishing, and then the other 50% is outdoor gear, packs, footwear. We carry a big amount of veteran owned coffees. So you can come in and get a bag of one of those roasts, a little camping section. So a lot of these things are going to be expanding in the future as we expand. We'll be carrying more lines. Of different brands, higher end brands that are great, you know. And the one thing I guess I would say too is that it seems like folks, like a lot of things in life, people really research, like, okay, why am I paying this amount of money for something? Does it really do what they are saying it does? And I would say, after being into the retail industry on clothing, at least for outdoor wear, it really does. Yep. It really does. You most of the companies will stand behind their products. Some companies are a lifetime warranty product. And other companies, as long as it's some kind of defect, they'll stand behind it. So when you have to pay a little extra to have that quality item in your hand for days of going out and fly fishing for trout in a rainstorm, and you're protected and you're not getting wet and you're comfortable so you can enjoy that sport, it's worth it.
And when you say that the season starts in January, mm-hmm. so that's some different equipment too than when you're fishing in, you know, July. That's a lot different.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we have a lot of people that will come in that are duck hunters that have like the neoprene heavy duty waders. So those are fantastic for the winter season because they're going to give you more protection and, you know, insulation. But as you transition into spring and summer, you're not wearing that heavy wader in the water. So the companies have come a long way where they have now what we call a 365 wader, where you wear the wader. And the layer systems that you can get through some of these major companies are so good that you just layer up underneath the wader and you're totally comfortable as if you were wearing a neoprene wader in the wintertime. So you're saving some money. Yeah, you're going to spend a little bit money on getting that 365-day wader, but you're saving money because you're not transitioning from one wader to the next. And the layering systems are just so awesome that you can use it for multiple applications, not just for fly fishing. Now, if you want to go on a hike, or if you want to go camping, now you have all this clothing that's, you're prepared for it.
So the short window when there's not fly fishing, what are your hobbies?
Working on the business. as a small business owner, you know, you're constantly doing that. I absolutely love spending time with my family. We have a very active family. Like I said, we try to do some downhill skiing. I have a 13-year-old son who's very, very involved in sports. So, football in the fall, and of course now we're into baseball season. Daughter's into dance. So we always are a night where we're all home to have dinner on the table used to be a thing, and now that I'm retired, ironically, it seems to be a thing of the past, just because we're so busy with so many different activities and things going on. So it's you have about a 3-week. Time frame in the fall where people usually transition from fishing to bow hunting and gun deer season, where it's a little quieter in the store. We're starting to look forward to those 3 weeks.
Right.
But then as soon as gun deer season seems to kick off and shop small and everything with the holidays, it just ramps right back up. And we love it. I mean, as you know, Eric, it's better when the store's buzzing than when the store's not. So we'll definitely take it. You know, when the sun's shining, we make hay, so to speak. So
right. Well, that makes your getaway to your cabin even more special for your busy family.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, the one of the only fly fishing stories I know is Orvis, right? You know the story how Orvis got started? The magazine. Orvis started, this big fly fishing company started when somebody was hand tying his flies. He was hand tying, and I don't know all the details. I'm sure we'll post something to the story. But he was putting them in newspaper advertisements, as, and I don't know the exact dollar amount, so say five hand-tied flies for a dollar, right? Wasn't getting a ton of bites or sales from that. So he put an ad out that said, free flies, $1 shipping, and could not keep up. It exploded his entire business. So people were like, I'm gonna buy get the free flies. I just got to pay $1 shipping. So it just, that psychology by itself is what launched an iconic kind of fly fishing brand.
Absolutely. They're huge. We actually just became an Orvis dealer. We'll be carrying Orvis products, but they're the long lineage that company has along with some of the other ones. It's just fantastic. And one of the other really unknown facts in Wisconsin, if I can drop a little bit of history for you guys. So Stevens Point, Wisconsin was known as the fly tying capital of the world at one time.
Well, that is a great little tidbit.
Yeah. Yes. So the real brief history of it is there was a lady by the name of Carrie Frost who started tying flies. And what would happen back in the day is that the wives would send their kids off to school and their husbands off to work. And they, before they got their daily chores going, they would go down to the Frost company and grab their bundle of flies material. They would go back home. They would tie their flies around the kitchen table and do all their chores. And at the end of the day, before they would receive the kids home and the husband home, they would take all these tied flies back to Carrie, and then she would sell them worldwide. And that grew and grew and grew, and then till other companies came along. The Worth Company now, which is still in down in Stevens Point, they don't tie flies anymore. The Weber Tackle Company down in Stevens Point, they sent flies all over the world. There was three major fly tying companies in Stevens Point. And I grew up in Wisconsin. I was not originally from Stevens Point. And as soon as I opened the fly shop, I had all these people coming in saying, do you know the history of Stevens Point? And it was just amazing. And to the fact where PBS actually just came and did a documentary on Stevens Point and part of the fly tying history. So the companies did extremely well. Well, then after the end of World War II, the treaties were signed in Southeast Asia. A lot of the industry then moved overseas. And that's kind of how that faded out of Stevens Point. But it was just really exciting to have some of the folks that have lived in Stevens Point their whole life come in and talk to me and tell me these stories. The owner of the Worth Company, who unfortunately had passed away recently, had come into my shop and sat with me for 2 hours and told me this whole history. And he says, well, go give me a handful of flies. I bet you I can tell you what these flies are. So I just went in there and randomly grabbed five of these flies and took them over. And he's like, this is that and that is that. It was just sharp. Wow. Gentleman was in his late 80s. Just super, super sharp. But that's just kind of a neat tidbit that I tell folks that they don't know that Stevens Point in Wisconsin was the fly tying capital of the world at one time.
So instead of quilting bees, the ladies in Stevens Point had fly tying bees or something.
Indeed. Indeed. No, absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought up that story. That's great.
Yeah. That talk about an attention to detail and patience I don't have. Do you use a big magnifying glass usually?
When you get older.
Yeah. Okay.
Or the magnifying glasses.
Yeah.
Generally when you're younger, you don't have them as you go on, and then those kind of come out.
And there's like a clamp. You put it in a little clamp.
Yep. They call it a vise. The vices have come a long way, but then, you put the fly in the vise and they've got all different types of tools to articulate, to get the thread around and the different materials. We went to a fly, before the pandemic, we went to, Minnesota has a huge fly fishing, expo. And there was a very young lady there who was tying flies. I think she was probably 10 or 11 years old. And she was tying flies, and they had it on the big screen, and it was very, very interesting. And she says, I'm tying flies with my dog hair.
Oh, wow.
So, it just goes to show that you can use really any material to emulate a fly. And she was using her dog hair. And then she passed the fly around when she was done. It's just amazing. Just amazing. So there's so many different things that folks will use. A lot of the hunters bucktails for, making musky flies. And there's just so many different materials that you can source. Like you were saying with your son, making the fly for you out of the buffalo.
Yeah.
Pretty neat.
So I'd love to hear some of our followers' stories too, of their fly fishing adventures, or if they tie flies, even to send us pictures of some of their adventures in tying. That would be really, really cool to see.
And then the poles, you brought a couple of poles. You want to talk a little bit about the two different poles that you bought? We'll share some pictures of those and kind of the history of where, how that started.
Yeah, sure. So I just brought two different polls just to kind of have a, just to talk a little bit about it. So, and I wrote down just a little bit, without going verbatim here, but so fly fishing started off with bamboo rods. And a lot of times we associate the bamboo rods as like heirlooms that were passed down. I know, you know, a lot of cabins probably have the bamboo fly rods hanging up in them. They're great decor pieces. So they call them bamboo rods. Ironically, in Britain, they call them split canes, just kind of a different way. They call it split canes. But those were originated in the 1870s, and they used the that particular bamboo rod up until about the 1950s. That was the main rod that they used. We still have a lot of folks that will come in with their bamboo rods into the shop and ask if they can use them, and we'll kind of look at them and say, you know, these are a little more for hanging on the wall. However, if you want to use them, you know, just use some care. But a lot of them, unfortunately, are just starting to deteriorate from all the years. And we always say they're better to be wall hangers than they are to go out and catch fish. But I know folks that do still use them. And then, excuse me. And then they kind of changed. So then the 1950s to the 70s, a lot of things went to fiberglass rods. So in World War II, they fiberglass became an item to use for aircraft. And they somebody came up with the idea of, hey, this fiberglass rod is pretty neat. This could be something we could use for fly fishing. So that was all the rage, you know, from World War II all the way, or excuse me, from the 50s all the way up through the 70s as they used the fiberglass rods, which I didn't bring. And then pretty much from 1970s to today, everything is graphite. And graphite came from the aerospace industry. It's so much more lightweight. It's more flexible. It can handle more of a load. So depending on what kind of fish that you catch. But that's kind of where we are right now. But I always tell folks, everything in life is cyclic. And we're now we're starting to see more folks that are coming back with more of the fiberglass rods. You know, they want to use fiberglass rods. And every rod in the material is going to give you a different feeling. So it's going to be different for every application. So it could be, you know, unique to that individual, depending on if they grew up on a fiberglass rod or if they grew up on a bamboo rod or, you know, graphite rod. So I just brought in a couple of examples of in to show and kind of explain the differences.
Oh, yeah, well, we could do some videoing of that to share on stories.
Absolutely.
On Instagram and Facebook.
Thank you so much for joining us today. That's been a wealth of knowledge. It's always fun to see things that other people are passionate about and different hobbies and then have them kind of brought to life in a more detailed, you know, detailed thing. So I think it's something I'll have to try out sometime soon.
Yeah. And if people have more questions for Craig too, they can send them to us at our email, getaway@thecabincast.com, or DM us on our socials, and we can always give them a call and ask some more questions.
Yeah, please do. It'd be great.
Awesome. Well, Craig, thank you so much for joining us at the Cabin Cast. We really appreciate you coming up here. And yeah, check out his Instagram. Is it just Fall Line Outfitters?
Yeah, it's Fall Line Outfitters, CO for company.
Okay.
So we're on Instagram, and then, of course, we're on Facebook as well.
Well, and we always end every episode with your best cabin day, and you kind of shared a little of what that looks like, but is there anything you want to add to what your best day at the cabin looks like?
I just think spending time with the family and, you know, I think there's something to be said about not only, you know, being at a cabin, not necessarily have to be on a lake because we've had hunting cabins before, but the camaraderie that you have with family is just the utmost important thing. And the memories that you create with your family, those are things that just live on forever. And they get passed down from generation to generation. I'm a very frequent listener of the Cabin Cast, and I always love hearing some of the folklore stories that you guys share on here as well and some of those things. So I think that would be a perfect day is to create those memories and to create stories for future generations.
Definitely. That's great.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Cabin Cast. You can find details and more information in the show notes on our website at www.thecabincast.com. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen so you won't miss a single episode. Follow us on your favorite social media channels. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at The Cabin Cast. We'd also love to hear from you. We want to hear your getaway and cabin stories. For a chance to have your story featured on an upcoming episode, email us at getaway@thecabincast.com. Until next week, enjoy the journey.